seated. The court is ready to hear arguments in file number 030987, Ross and Koenig, Inc. v. Hedeberg Chevrolet, Inc.
May it please the court, Mr. Sandy McCorkadale will present arguments for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
I'm Sandy McCorkadale. I represent Petitioner Ross and Koenig. I've got 10 minutes of the argument. My co-counsel has 10 minutes of the argument. I've not reserved any time for rebuttal. The principal issue...
So you're going to talk... You're going to present for 10 minutes and then...
I'm going to present for 10 and then hand it over to him.
And no
I do not have any of my time reserved for rebuttal.
Okay.
The principal issue that Ross and Koenig is interested in this case is... whether there is any right on the part of Hedeberg to statutory indemnity when the pleadings that were filed against Hedeberg in the Anderson lawsuit did not specifically allege a defect in the service body that was manufactured by Ross and Koenig.
What if they had?
Then that, under Chapter 82, would probably have a product liability action alleged. If the petition said that the service body manufactured and distributed by Ross and Koenig had a defect in it, and the defect was a producing cause for the plaintiff's injuries and damages, then that would seem to fit the definition under Chapter 82, which seems to be pleadings driven. Now,
and then take me through that. If even if the defendants win that case, Ross and Koenig would be liable to Hedeberg Chevrolet for indemnity.
That certainly seems to be the structure of Chapter 82 as it was originally envisioned, that it didn't matter how that lawsuit would be resolved. It did not matter. If you tried the lawsuit and you succeeded on the merits, it was a complete defense verdict, you would owe indemnity. If there was a defect found, you would owe indemnity. That if Hedeberg settled, that under Chapter 82, as Ross and Koenig, you could not litigate the issue of whether there was anything wrong with your product. And certainly, I think most people thought that was the key feature of Chapter 82 and how it differed from common law indemnity, is that it relieved the seller of the obligation of proving in the indemnity lawsuit that there was a defect in fact in the component part or in the product supplied to it by the manufacturer. Bostrom kind of comes out of the blue and says that Bostrom has both a common law indemnity claim and a statutory indemnity claim, and then winds up holding that both claims lose because there is no evidence of a defect in the component part itself. And that, written into Chapter 82, changes certainly the way we saw the case as it progressed through the lower courts and the
Bostrom
court of appeals.
Was a little bit different because the plaintiff in that case, the injured party, did not sue the component part manufacturer and did not allege that that seat in and of itself was defective.
Which is what we have here with Ross and Koenig. We were not named by the plaintiff in the suit.
I'm just saying, your case aside, we did all in that we were careful to say in that case there were no allegations against the seat to the component part manufacturer, and there was no evidence at all that the component part manufacturer was negligent. So, or was had a product defect. What happens in a case where everybody is ultimately proved at the end of a trial innocent? Is there indemnity up and down the line or not?
If everybody is ultimately proved innocent, the answer appears to be that from the viewpoint of the seller that there is indemnity. That the fact that there is no defect in your product, the fact that you have done nothing wrong, Chapter 82 on its face does not appear to make that a defense.
The problem with this is obviously the component part manufacturers. And for example, the plaintiff in this case could have alleged that there was something wrong with the muffler as well as everything else, or with the exhaust manifold, or with the bolts that hook the motor to attach the motor to the frame. And if the plaintiff had done that, then under the theory that you just espoused, which is a reasonable interpretation of the statute, all of those people would be liable for indemnity to whoever, to Hudeberg or whoever the ultimate seller was. Isn't that, I mean, doesn't it follow that that would be the case?
That is what follows. In the lower,
that doesn't seem reasonable.
No. In fact, we had argued and were successful in the trial court that that was one of the reasons that the statute was unconstitutional. The Court of Appeals said, no, you're premature on that argument. First, you have to be found liable under the statute before you can raise your constitutional argument. And we elected not to bring that up here on this round, thinking, well, we'll go back to the lower court and have our trial, and if we're found liable, then we'll go to the same judge and say you found it unconstitutional on that ground before, do it again, overturn whatever the result was of the trial, let's go back to the Court of Appeals saying that this time we're not premature in that challenge. But, yeah, it imposes this huge problem of you transfer these enormous liabilities to, for example, component part manufacturers. You've got gaps in the statute, like what determines whether it's a product liability action in which petition. Now we've proceeded down the road where you'll see in the record that we've used the Third Amendment petition from the Anderson suit, which was a live pleading at the time of trial. What do you do with a plaintiff that files, for example, an original petition and says the Koenig service body obviously had a defect in it and it was the producing cause of the damages, does 4 months of discovery and says, well, I was completely wrong, files an amended petition, doesn't say anything about the Koenig service body. And then you go off in your Hudeberg and you settle. Certainly, as Hudeberg, you'd have an argument, well, that's a product liability action because at one time there was an allegation in the lawsuit there was a defect in the component part.
But the concept of indemnity is the person that made the defective or allegedly defective component bears the cost for defending it.
That's certainly the concept of Chapter 82, is that you transfer that cost. And even for non-defective products.
And that it ought to be the plaintiff rather than the defendant that picks out the defective component. So if the plaintiff says it's the Firestone tires that called the flip over, the defendant can't try the case, win, and then sue the sun visor manufacturer and say, you indemnify me for my costs.
Yeah, if the component part is in fact identified, that is correct. And there's nothing unusual about that because all the time in indemnity cases, you see that the question of indemnity turns on what was the nature of the liability that was alleged against the indemnity.
If you're a car dealer, why wouldn't you encourage the plaintiff to sue quite a number of component parts manufacturers that is along with the car manufacturer so that you're going to get indemnity no matter what?
Yeah, that's one of the perhaps unintended consequences. Another unintended consequence of the statute is the very astute plaintiff who goes to the component part manufacturer like Koenig and says, I have not alleged there was a defect in your product. Give me money and settle with me, or else I'm going to allege there was a defect in your product, that I'm going to trigger the Chapter 82 rights for the dealer. I mean, there's certainly ways that you can manipulate the statute if you wanted to.
Kind of do a bidding.
Yeah.
You can go to the target defendant.
Yeah. What you do
say,
have
if you
to
don't
do
pay me some more money, I'm not going to put these people in, and then you can go to them.
Yeah, and that is a product of the inability to defend yourself by saying there's nothing wrong with my product like you could in the common law indemnity action. What the statute does not do, which is what Hudeberg argues for, is where you have an allegation that says the vehicle was defective, but that is to be considered an allegation that each and every component part of the vehicle was defective and that triggers some right of indemnity against all the component part suppliers for the entire vehicle.
But to follow that along, how much is enough? I mean, if they say, well, it's defective because the bed separated from the chassis and that fuel tank leaked, and that's what caused the fire. Is that it, even if you don't say, and not only that, but GM made the chassis and Koenig made the bed?
I think you can probably cogently say that you do not have to list the name of the manufacturer of the particular component part. If you have sufficient information in the pleadings from which you can clearly identify the component part, and you can look to, I would think at that point, perhaps some extrinsic evidence of who was the manufacturer. If the suit's against Target and it says, I bought this red basketball and it blew up and it injured me, and Target knows it only bought red basketballs from one particular manufacturer and that manufacturer is not named, you could look at extrinsic evidence because you have enough information from the pleading alleging the defect in the product that you could go identify a manufacturer, and the component part really wouldn't be much different from that. Here, the allegation that you may have is an allegation with regard to the fuel system. And then you take, the question is, can you go beyond that pleading? Can you look at extrinsic evidence and argue about whose component part is the fuel system? Is it a part of the chassis? Are they GM-supplied parts? Should it properly be considered part of Koenig's product? Is it something that really comes from the final stage assembler, B&M, which actually supplies one last third-party part from somebody that's not ever been a party to any of the litigation? And there you get into this tension of what the court has said before, that you're trying to determine, is it a product liability action that triggers the duty to indemnify from the pleadings themselves, or how far can you go behind the pleadings where you have to have at times some information to fill in the gap as to who the manufacturer is.
Counsel, let's shift gears a little bit. Let me make sure I understand some basics. The service body, is that the bed of the truck?
The service body is the built-up part that goes onto the flat chassis on the back. It's sold as what's called a knockdown unit, which is a bunch of flat sheet metal that shipped with installation instructions to a company, a final stage assembler like B&M, which receives the chassis where you've got the cab and just the flat chassis. And then it's effectively would be like a pickup bed, only it's a much larger structure that contains a number of storage compartments on it. That's what the service bed is.
Is there any contention in our court that the service body itself was defective?
We don't believe that there is any contention that the service body itself was defective.
What do you mean by we don't believe there is? Has it been asserted or not?
Yeah, it's been asserted. I mean, clearly we say that there is nothing in the Anderson pleading that says that there was a defect in the service body that was manufactured by Koenig.
So the whole argument is about the how it was attached, how it was put together, that and the fuel system as well.
Yeah, and that fuel system part is part of the installation, how it's put together. And one of the distinctions that we make is that when we get to the part of the argument that addresses the independent liability of the seller, that independent liability, in a case like this, when you have a seller who causes a final assembly to be made from a group of component parts, that can include the defects that arise, if any, from the final assembly are solely the province of the seller who has had that final assembly made.
Your 10 minutes has expired. So take as much time as you
want. Let me just finish this one point then. What you can't do is take a series of non-defective component parts as a seller, cause this assembly to be made, and then when there is a defect in the assembly, as alleged in this case, turn around and say, well, I'm going to pass that liability on under Chapter 82 to all the suppliers of the non-defective component parts. That's just not the way that it works. So, yeah, I'll pass my time. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Aaron Dwyer. I represent GM. Time permitting, I'd like to address two issues. The first being the language of the statute. In fact, the issues were the subject of the past 10 minutes. And I will tell you, I will present a slightly different view of the application of the statute that I think addresses many of the questions that have been asked by the panel, although perhaps it may provoke different types of questions, the interpretation I have. The second issue, if time permits, I'd like to spend a brief moment talking about some of the evidentiary issues that are presented with respect to General Motors' summary judgment motion. But back to the first issue. Both sides have parsed the language of the statute in some detail. Both allege that at least the plain meaning of the statute supports their position. In the case of Hüdeberg, that interpretation is that a seller can always seek indemnity from every manufacturer, including a component manufacturer. I think that interpretation is clearly false. In fact, I think this court's decision in Bostrom in June undermines that interpretation. The second is Hüdeberg alleges they are an innocent seller so long as they did not commit the act that gives rise to the loss. In other words, they disclaim responsibility for the acts of any third party that they introduce into the transaction. In contrast, what we say is that the statute actually says a manufacturer. It doesn't say all manufacturers. Second, the statute presupposes that the seller seeking indemnity is an innocent seller, we say, an innocent seller as to the manufacturer from whom they seek indemnity. So, if there is an act by a third party for whom that seller is responsible, in this case the installation by B&M that we say Hudeberg is liable for, and that is independent of any liability the seller would have derivative of the manufacturer from whom they seek indemnity, in this case that liability would clearly be derivative, would be unrelated and non-derivative to any liability GM would have, then in that case the exclusion applies. This interpretation is consistent not only with the statute, but also the common law that underlies the statute. If you look at all the old common law cases, they are always talking about indemnity being in the concept of a derivative type liability.
But,
in other words,
General Motors could, if its product, if the chassis had been defective,
correct,
could be liable for indemnity.
Understood.
And the plaintiff says it is, and the plaintiff loses, and the statute says that doesn't matter.
Correct.
As long as the plaintiff says General Motors' chassis was a problem, then it seems to true.
I would agree with that.
So if you have those allegations and that situation in this case, then how does General Motors escape indemnity?
But that's not the case we have here, Justice Heck. The way this case is presented is that what we're talking about is the liability with respect to the service bed installation and the detachment of the service bed. All allegations with respect to the fuel tank itself were settled by General Motors independently. So when this case is presented to this court, what we're talking about is a summary judgment where General Motors and Ross and Koenig have produced evidence that the installation of the service bed, in fact, was negligent, that it caused losses. That's the loss we're here about. That's the loss we say excludes Hudeberg from the operation of Chapter 82's indemnity provision. Now, assuming, and if we ever get to the evidentiary point, and I may or may not, but assuming that's true, and we've established that, Hudeberg still takes the position that they can still seek indemnity from General Motors, even for that liability that is unrelated to the General Motors chassis, simply because General Motors is in the stream of manufacturers that ultimately produced a part that went into the complete installation.
But help me now with the statute. If instead of the way we have this case, if the allegation is that the chassis manufacturer and the bed manufacturer were both responsible, as well as Hudeberg, and everybody is sued, and everybody settles on the same day, or even if it goes to trial and the defendants all win, then wouldn't General Motors still be liable for indemnity? Or
well, hence comes my interpretation of the statute. I believe the only way you can interpret this statute in a way that makes sense and accomplishes the objectives of an innocent seller seeking indemnity from his manufacturer is to assume that there really is only one manufacturer for every potential seller from whom indemnity can be sought. And that potential manufacturer is, in fact, the manufacturer of the product that that seller sold. Because it is only as to that product that the seller can claim to be the innocent seller. So in this case,
the assembler.
Correct. B&M is the manufacturer under the statute from whom Hudeberg would have indemnity, and we don't contest that. The real issue in this case is what happens when that manufacturer is insolvent? What happens when the person from whom the seller is entitled to seek indemnity under the statute isn't in a position to give that indemnity? Does that seller then get to go upstream?
That seems to read out the component parts piece of it, because you can have a manufacturer and a component part.
But the reason the component parts is included in the definition of manufacturer is you also have component parts sellers. Those sellers haven't sold assembled products. Those sellers themselves can be liable for liability that attaches under product liability law for a component defect. Those persons have to have somebody to look to for indemnity. We take the position that the person they look to under the statute, and hence the reason it is included in the definition, is the component part manufactured?
But you contend that Hudeberg is not an innocent seller. I assume because they picked B&M and they selected also the part in the absence of the buyer.
This is Wainwright. As to G&M, as to GM, yes, we would agree. As to B&M, then I think Hudeberg would still be an innocent seller because they would be able to, in fact, pass off that liability. Theirs is completely derivative of the assemblers. They would be the person secondarily liable from the position of the primary liable party, which again is B&M. And then it would flow with all the case law. And it would be much like this court said in Bonnewell when it talked about preserving the innocent retailer exclusion when it got rid of the other elements of common law liability, that the undermining basis for indemnity is the concept of unjust enrichment, and that the party that gets indemnity essentially is passing off the liability that has attached to it to the party ultimately responsible for that liability.
Let me make sure I understand your construction. Let's say there's a crash word in this case. The plaintiff sues the local GM dealer, GM, and also sues the designer of the fuel system and the component part fuel people. At trial, there's no liability. Every jury finds no defect. Who has to indemnify whom for defense costs?
In the context of the dealer, I assume you mean the Chevrolet dealer, for example, then Chevrolet would have that claim against General Motors, their seller.
What about the parts manufacturer?
The parts manufacturer, I don't think, would have a claim of indemnity against anybody.
No, would the local dealership have a claim for indemnity for its defense cost against the component parts manufacturer?
I actually believe, Your Honor, the way the statute should be interpreted that eliminates these problems that have been raised here is the answer is no.
What
their indemnity right would be against their
manufacturer. What if the manufacturer is bankrupt, but the component parts manufacturer isn't?
I think that's the risk that the sellers take. They are the ones who deal with their manufacturers. Somebody has to take the risk of an insolvency there. The only way to make that work is to make it the person you deal with. And in the case of the statute, you're intending to shift liability from the manufacturer to the innocent retailer who sells his products. If that person goes bankrupt, then I think that risk is out there on the seller.
Does GM get indemnity from the component part manufacturer?
Yes.
Where they're all innocent.
Each one.
I'm assuming it would be, in fact, a defective component part. No. In the case of a non-defective part, no. General Motors simply, as part of doing business, has to shoulder the cost of its dealers who are innocent of some claim that's asserted against them simply because they sold a GM product.
But seller is the component part manufacturer is defined as a seller too. Do they get indemnity from GM?
Well, then I think you're in the case of like Bostrom. You could have a case where a manufacturer could in fact have indemnity against his component part manufacturer in the case like that, because I think that's what Bostrom says. If in fact that component part manufacturer did manufacture something defective,
it was
the allegation
not,
was
there. Not defective. In my example, the plaintiff sues the dealership, GM, and the component parts manufacturer. The jury says there's no defect up and down the line.
Then would GM have indemnity against a component part manufacturer?
Or vice versa, does the component parts manufacturer have indemnity against GM? Because component part manufacturer is both a seller and a manufacturer under the statute.
I guess that's right, Your Honor. In that case, I guess they would. I haven't really thought that through.
Who gets indemnity from whom?
In that case, I guess under the statute, you could argue that they, too, are a seller. I don't know. I haven't thought through that example. It so rarely comes up, so it hasn't occurred to me before.
Thank you, counsel.
Let me test your assertion that Hudeberg is not innocent as to B&M, or is not innocent as to GM in this case, but is as to B&M. The reason Hudeberg is not innocent as to GM is it picked a manufacturer that caused problems. They put the parts together negligently, allegedly. If that's the reason why Hugeberg is not innocent as to GM, why would that change when you look at Hugeberg vis-a-vis B&M?
Well,
still pick the negligent components, the person who put the components together.
The innocence as to G&M isn't excluded so much because they pick the person. It is simply because, as to G&M, Hugeberg is not a mere conduit. They took our product, they altered it, they did something to it. Whether they selected them, somebody else volunteered, whether they did a good job of picking the right person, whether they failed to inspect it, all of those are factors, but the real answer comes once we send them a part and they go do anything with it, they're no longer simply a conduit for our part, which is a way it's expressed in many of the cases, a mere conduit, an innocent retailer. In the case of B&M, they are, in fact, a mere conduit. B&M, under the law, is the final assembler, the final manufacturer of that vehicle. Hugeberg sells that vehicle.
Thank you, Councilman.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent. The marshals will add 5 minutes to the respondent's time.
May it please the court, Mr. Charles Frazier will present argument for the respondent.
Good morning, and may it please the court.
Mr. Frazier?
Yes.
Are there allegations that the service body itself is defective, or is it just what was done to it and the fuel system were defectively done?
We believe the innocent petition, Your Honor, alleges that the vehicle, when sold, that included an attached service bed, was defective.
That the truck was defective.
That the vehicle, when sold, was defective. And paragraph 12 goes into great detail in the petition to talk about the service bed at all times, when it was sold, when the crash occurred, and every time in between had on it or was attached to the truck. So there was a long allegation. It's on page 4 of the petition. It goes through a long detail, Your Honor, that the service bed was attached. And they claim that Hugeberg was responsible for it being there, but it's very detailed about how it had on there.
That's kind of a tactful answer.
Yes, it's page 334.
The truck was defective.
Yes.
My question is, was the service bed alleged itself, the part, to be defective? And your answer is that the truck was alleged to be defective and the service bed was attached to the truck.
There is no allegation in the innocent petition that says, quote, the service bed was defective. That is not in the petition, Your Honor. What we are arguing, that's on page 334 of the record, and they go into detail, is that the service bed is addressed, it is mentioned, the context of the petition, that there was a fire, and the record shows that the fuel system was an integral part of the service bed, that the vehicle, when sold, and they go into detail in the petition, Your Honors, of what is involved here. This cab chassis that GM brings to Hugeberg has to have a bed on it before it can be driven off by a consumer. It cannot be licensed unless there is a component part put on. It is made with the intention that there would be an assembly of a component part on it.
Now,
that's the difference.
If it is the case that there's no allegation or proof that the service body itself was defective, why doesn't Bostrom Seating in this case as to General Motors?
As to General Motors? Well, Your Honor, Bostrom was talking about that if there is no proof of a component part being defective. Here, we're talking about Chapter 82, indemnity between co-defendants or between manufacturers. We believe that Bostrom was relying upon cases dealing with the product manufacturer's liability to the consumer. Here, Chapter 82, as this court held Fitzgerald, creates new duties and favors the seller. What has to be in the petition, Your Honor, is an allegation that the product was defective.
Did you give notice to them while this lawsuit, the interest suit, was pending?
Yes, to Ross and Koenig?
Yes.
We brought them in as a third-party defendant,
right. Right.
In the underlying Anderson petition or a case. So, yes, we gave them notice. We looked at the petition that although it didn't have the magic words, service bed was defective, it said that the cab chassis came to Hugeberg, it was assembled with a service bed at all material times throughout the entire process. It goes to great length to make that point. Then it says the vehicle, when sold, which had an attached service bed, was defective. The definition of a manufacturer, as this court was discussing, includes component part manufacturers. So the vehicle, when sold, was defective, includes the component parts. It has to. I mean, a vehicle has component parts. And the allegations in the petition, and we think the Court of Appeals rule is a reasonable rule, reasonably construe the petition. I think, as counsel mentioned, it may not even identify the manufacturer. It may just identify the product. And that's what Chapter 82 is all about. The product is alleged to be defective. It doesn't have to go and name each component part manufacturer. But a seller, like Hudeberg, who was required by law to have this assembled, and it doesn't have the means to do so itself, the evidence shows that it doesn't have the expertise, it sends it out. And by the way, there is no evidence that Hudeberg was negligent in selecting B&M. There is no evidence of that. There's no negligent hiring or retention proof in
but
this case.
If this pleading gets you there, then why can't you sue the manufacturer of the muffler if it's somebody other than GM or the boats? Surely the boats are made by somebody else. Or bumper or anybody who made a piece that was incorporated into the vehicle for Nimbeth.
That's where the reasonably construed test takes care of that. On one hand, you have Ross and Koenig's extreme view that you have to identify literally every part manufactured and that it was defective. We don't think that's the test because that puts the seller at the whim of the drafter of the court claims petition. On the other hand, the statute says manufacturers include component part manufacturers. So if the end product is alleged to be defective, that could conceivably, by definition of the statute, it's paragraph 014, could include everybody. The Court of Appeals is a reasonably limiting rule that we believe the court should affirm or adopt because it allows a seller who's in the real world who assembled this or had it assembled knows that when the allegations are a fire, it's turned on inside, a violent collision, ought to be able to look at a petition and reasonably construe it to see which manufacturer is named or which product is named of the completed product. Because the statute does nowhere say that it's up to one manufacturer. This court has used the phrase manufacturers in its decision in Fitzgerald, acknowledging the reality, as does the statute, that you have more than one manufacturer. The idea is to protect innocent sellers. On this record, there was no evidence that Hudeberg was not innocent.
But
there is no evidence.
Surely you're not any more innocent than General Motors. I mean, all they did was sell a chassis.
Well, they sold a chassis that had to be assembled before it could be actually sold to the consumer. There is an allegation in the petition, in which we were named as a defendant, that General Motors sold it had a defective product. So the fact that they don't have to prove their innocence, it's not the manufacturer's innocence. That doesn't have to be proved here in Chapter 82. And all due respect to the Bostrom decision, Chapter 82 focuses on an innocent seller being indemnified from the manufacturer. As this court stated, Fitzgerald, the legislature decided to favor sellers. It wants to protect both manufacturers and sellers, but it favors sellers, the innocent seller.
But the idea seems to be, and this statute is only marginally better than the last statutes in the first case, but the idea seems to be that in a very simple situation where you have strict liability, everybody in the chain's liable, consumer, we're going to protect the consumer, you can sue anybody, and the retailer just literally takes it out of the ship, out of the box, puts it on the shelf, somebody comes in, that's the sole, his sole involvement. It seems like it's a perfectly rational decision to say that fella ought to get his cost back, expenses of litigation back from the guy who made the product in the first place, since as between the two of them, that seems fair. But if it gets more complicated when the person upstream is only making a little part of the ultimate product, and that was the problem in Bostrom, some allegation that the seat that was included in the vehicle was defective, but of course we had a different problem there regarding what the plaintiff pleaded. But how does your view of this work when you have this whole, even if you have a reasonable view that the Court of Appeals has, how are we going to tell who in this universe of parts manufacturers should indemnify the downstream person?
Well, the Court of Appeals test, Your Honor, is a limiting test that limits the universe or locus of manufacturers to avoid the proverbial spark plug hubcap manufacturer. And so the Court of Appeals is saying you've got to give a seller some latitude. If you can't have a specific allegation from the context of this petition.
But if the plaintiff had actually sued that person or named
the bed.
But or the spark plug manufacturer.
According to the statute.
Right.
According to the statute. And as this court has stated in Fitzgerald, that you look at the pleading and that if it's alleged to, under the notice provision, if it alleges a product is defective, then you give that manufacturer notice. And there you go. And if the seller is innocent, there has to be a finding. There's no finding that the seller is independently liable. There's nothing in this record at this stage. There's no record, no evidence of that in Hudeberg. Then the statute, which is aimed to protect innocent sellers, allows the seller to seek indemnity from that manufacturer. And if they happen to allege in the petition, whatever manufacturer it is, whether it may not make sense that it was involved or not, this court, look at the pleadings, if that's what we have to go on, then that would be the case.
What if a court finds that the manufacturer was named without any basis in law or fact? It was a completely frivolous pleading. Then the indemnity obligation still arises?
Yes, Your Honor, because I think that may be a different issue, but vis-a-vis the innocent seller who is being sued and asked to is defending itself, when it gives notice to that manufacturer, your product is alleged to be defective in this lawsuit, then the manufacturer has a decision to make. Does it let the seller go and defend itself, or does it come in and defend like it should? This is what this is about, to get manufacturers in the case early to defend. And if they want to write out and say, well, no, my product wasn't implicated, well, they may prove that later, but as far as the claim for indemnity that Hudeberg has, it's irrelevant. They have to pay, they have to indemnify Hudeberg for its costs in defending the suit, its litigation costs, attorney's fees, and if it settles. That's what the statute is there for, and now it's to encourage manufacturers to come in and defend these innocent sellers. That's the whole purpose. And so under that scenario, Your Honor, if it proves later to be frivolous and you have a Rule 13 violation pleading, as far as an innocent seller, Hudeberg's concerned, that we still get indemnity.
Do you contend you did not modify or alter the product?
We did not modify the product.
You paid somebody else to.
We sent it out to B&M, an independent contractor who was a licensed Koenig bed dealer, to
attach.
But that's
between you and the buyer of the vehicle. You altered or modified the product.
The product had to have a service bed, yes.
And so, doesn't it seem reasonable in the statute, though, that you did, your client, altered or modified the product?
Your Honor, our position is that the statute requires that the seller commit an act. B&M was an independent contractor. Yes, we chose them.
Well, let's say that I have a lot, and I hire you as a home builder to go build a house for me, and you hire a subcontractor who does something bad and it's defective in my home, you're still liable. I mean, you can't say to me, an independent contractor did it, I'm sorry, it's not my problem. As between us, you're liable. You're independently liable because you're the general contractor.
Well, I would be strictly liable in a products liability sense.
Well,
yes.
Well, you're also liable under common law warranties, aren't you?
Well, if you would have to go and prove. There are a couple of court appeals cases. I don't think this court has decided whether someone who employs a subcontractor and knows that subcontractor is totally
incompetent.
Well,
I buy a home from you and it's defective, and I don't see how you can say, as between me, the buyer, that you're not liable for it.
Well, as between, well, as my, the liability between the general contractor and the consumer, you, the buyer, yes, under that hypothetical, there will be liability. Here, we're dealing with the indemnity between the seller and manufacturer, not liability to the consumer. And that's the difference. Chapter 82 is between the seller and the manufacturer, and whether or not there is liability to the consumer.
As between the buyer of the vehicle, Peterbard and B&M, and then GM over here, you're independently liable to that buyer, regardless of what GM did or didn't do.
For purposes of the statute, Your Honor, for the independent liability would have to be an act by Peterbard, and we don't believe that being vicariously liable for the conduct of an independent contractor is what the statute means by independent liability. The new 003 section, that's not a part of this case because it's not retroactive, talks about the seller is a non-manufacturer seller is completely innocent, can walk away in summary judgment unless there is proof that there are certain things happening.
That's
well, that makes them strictly liable.
But you are a manufacturer. The fact that you hired somebody else to do it doesn't mean that you're not a manufacturer. I mean, it seems to me GM could subcontract out all of its vehicle constructing to independent contractors, but it's still liable as a manufacturer.
As a manufacturer, it is. But we are not a manufacturer. We get a product that is designed by General Motors to be assembled at some point in time before it is purchased. And dealerships are not capable or qualified to do the assembly work. And General Motors knows that. And we send it out as is anticipated. And that assembler, that independent assembler, does a bad job or is negligent, and somehow that causes, that does not mean that that is an independent act of negligence for which we are prohibited from seeking indemnity. That's not the way the statute reads. There's no evidence that we knew that B&M was incompetent.
And if there had been?
Well, if there was evidence that we chose an incompetent independent contractor that we knew or should have known, and that they were incompetent because of prior happenstance of prior occurrences, then there is some court of appeals case law in Texas that says that we would owe a third party a duty to select a competent subcontractor or independent contractor if that were the case. That hasn't been briefed. It's not before the court. But under that hypothetical, there could be independent liability. In this case, though, there is no evidence that B&M was incompetent. In fact, Mr. Rawson of Rawson Koenig said that B&M, he was comfortable with their capabilities. They were an authorized Koenig bed dealer. That's who we send it to, not some fly-by-night store down the road. And so we complied with what was going to have to happen from the General Motors cab chassis. We had to do that. And so the seller, like Hüdeberg, has to be protected, and that's what Chapter 82 is all about. It's sued unless there's a finding that we were negligent somehow in picking B&M, perhaps, or some other independent act of negligence, then we don't get indemnity. Otherwise, we're protected, we're favored under Chapter 82, and we get our indemnity from the manufacturer. The product was alleged in this petition to be defective. It goes out its way to describe the service bed. The service bed is integrated and connected with the fuel system in ways that the tires, the spark plugs, and hubcaps are not. That is in this record.
Do you think the same result would obtain under the common law?
Well, under the common law, I mean, the duties under Chapter 82 are different. Under the common law, then it's, you know, we would have to prove, of course, the defect. And under the common law, if the seller has culpability, then yes, it does not get indemnity under the common law. So in that instance, Your Honor, it would be the same. So the Anderson petition is sufficient. It alleges that the product, the completed product, was defective. And we gave notice very soon in that lawsuit to Rosen Koenig to come in. And well, we brought them in. And they did not participate in the underlying settlement, but they were brought in. So we followed the statute. There is no proof that we are not innocent. We had to have it assembled. That's the way it was given to us. And we disagree with the contention that you only look at one manufacturer. The statute does not limit that. It realizes the real world that there is, there are more than one manufacturer to any product these days. If I may briefly address to go over the evidence, just to make it clear, on this record, there is no evidence that the petitioners conclusively proved that B&M conduct was a proximate cause of this crash. On that record, therefore, the claim that we are not innocent goes away. The claim that we had a duty to inspect goes away. And we're left with General Motors' constitutional arguments, I know which were not argued, and then the Anderson petition issue, which we, of course, are not arguing today. On this record, they did not get there. The court recently issued the Cedars Hospital versus Mason case, going into the substantial factor test and what has to be proven. This record does not get there. It's conclusory at best. There was no evidence that this tragic accident on the interstate highway at speeds exceeding 50 miles an hour would have happened any differently had that bed been attached in a different way. They're not able to say that the fire would not have occurred but for, that the injuries would have been lessened but for. There is no evidence in this record on that. And so I won't go into that unless the court has questions on the evidence. But
there
that's
is,
the first
there
point.
Is, however, some expert testimony that these matters, the installation of the service body onto the chassis, contributed to the injuries, isn't there?
Yes.
Exacerbated the fire, contributed to worsening the injuries suffered by the plaintiffs.
Well,
there's some evidence of contributing to the injuries, though.
Well, as to our case, failure to provide a safe method of attaching the bed was a contributing cause of the hose tearing off, which in turn contributed to the fire. Well, first of all, that addresses RK. There is one statement, well, that's really all they go to. It's causally related, and causally related is not but-for causation. It's conclusory. But even though there's a fact issue that there was a connection, we have Mike James' affidavit that B&M's attachment held up in the impact better than RK's clamp method of attachment. So even then, there's a fact issue, as we argue in our briefs, on causation. We don't think they get there because it's conclusory. A contributing cause or causally related, that's too amorphous, and this court has held that. Like in Mason, you've got to be more direct. You've got to state without conclusory fashion. But there's a fact issue in any event, Your Honor.
Oh, contributing cause establishes but-for causation.
Just but-for, yes.
But not substantial factor.
Well, substantial factor is, and but-for, as this court held in Mason, are kind of the same thing or related.
Two parts.
It's
of
a subpart
of
but-for
and substantial factor.
Yes.
You're saying contributing to only establishes but-for, but not substantial factor.
It's conclusory, I think, on both, frankly, Your Honor, that they just didn't get there on this record. And so if there is no conclusory, there's no evidence that they conclusively proved a connection between what B&M did, then whether or not their conduct is imputed to us, that somehow that we are responsible under the hypothetical of the seller, the subcontractors, the builder, the court need not go there. But in any event, we believe that Chapter 82, as this court held in Fitzgerald, creates a new duty on manufacturers. It's different than the common law. It's in addition to the common law. And based upon this record, this petition, we gave notice to the manufacturers, the two main parts. We're not talking about some small part. We're talking about the service bed and the cab chassis. You have to have those two parts. That's what makes this truck. That you have to have a bed on this truck for it to be purchased and driven by a consumer. And we are
if
seeking
you didn't, to... if it was a van that sometimes people fix up differently, would that be different?
If it was a van?
Well, you say part of the problem with General Motors is that they're anticipating that something else is going to have to be done to this chassis. Mm-hmm. But if they didn't, if the vehicle was something that could be modified, was frequently modified, but they didn't anticipate that it had to be modified, would that make a difference with respect to General Motors?
No, Your Honor, because the petition, if it still alleges that the van was defective when sold, in other words, barring any finding of liability, independent liability on Hudeberg, we would still have the right to seek indemnity under the statute against General Motors under the hypothetical. We respectfully ask this court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. This clause is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.
All right.